Growing up on the outskirts of San Jose, California on a horse ranch, Jared Allen's childhood laid the foundation for his remarkable journey. Committed to his aspirations, Jared went on to become a five-time Pro Bowl and four-time All-Pro selection during his 12-year NFL career, concluding with the ninth highest career sack total in league history. Despite initially being drafted for long snapping, he swiftly established himself as a dominant pass rusher with the Kansas City Chiefs, later playing for the Minnesota Vikings, Chicago Bears, and Carolina Panthers. Beyond the football, Jared's adventurous spirit led to a series of unique experiences, and his commitment to service inspired the establishment of the nonprofit Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors. Coming up next on Veteran on the Move.
Welcome to Veteran on the Move. If you're a veteran in transition, an entrepreneur wannabe, or someone still stuck in that J-O-B trying to escape, this podcast is dedicated to your success. And now, your host, Joe Crane.
Becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union can help you earn more and save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than your standard savings accounts with competitive rates. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. All right, today we're talking with NFL player Jared Allen with Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors. Jared, awesome having you on the show today. We usually talk about what you did in the military, but we really want to hear about what your NFL career and how you grew up and how you, your sports career, and ultimately how you ended up in the NFL. So if you could take us back and tell us where you grew up and how all that worked.
Absolutely. So I grew up in Northern California on a reining and cutting horse ranch. I was born in Texas, but left Texas when I was like two. So I can't, Texas still likes to claim me, but I can't really claim Texas. Unfortunately, California used to be cool to claim. Now it's a little wackadoo over there. But anyway. So I grew up on a ranch out in California. But I mean, I knew I wanted to be a professional football player from the minute I was born. Told my dad when I was 8 years old, I was going to play professional football. And I have one of those crazy dads that was like all in about that. Cool. And so he pushed me from a young age to reach those goals, and right, wrong, or indifferent, it worked out. But you know, that's how football is just always what it was for me. I love baseball growing up too. I quit all their sports when I was in seventh grade just to focus on football. Again, don't recommend that. Not employing that with my children. But you know, it's definitely, again, I'm one of those rare cases that I've known at a young age what I want to do. And, you know, God had me destined to do it. So I tried to screw it up along the way several times, but he got me where I wanted to be. So that's the short version of that. And like I said, it's one of those things where I've always known. And, you know, like you said, I had a support structure that didn't downplay it, you know, even at a young age. Old man would drop me off at the bottom of the, at the gate at the end of the driveway. It was about a mile back up to the house, and he'd be like, run, you know, you got to eat, sleep, drink this. If you want to be, you know, if you want to be successful. His old motto is, you know, if, you know, there's always someone out there doing it bigger and better than you are. So you better be working. Yeah. He instilled, you know, obviously good work ethic in me, and that's where I was able to accomplish those goals.
Awesome. Where was it you went to college?
So I went to Idaho State. I joked about trying to screw that one up. I committed to the University of Washington, but we had a I was a junior, but we had a football prank. We thought it would be really funny to steal all the yearbooks. Unfortunately, the school did not think it was nearly as funny as we did, and they kicked me out of school for it. And wow. So holy, I ended up losing like 13 four-ride scholarships, ended up at Idaho State. So, but it all works out for the better. Character building is what I say. Character building.
Man, awesome story. Well, when your kids pull off something similar, then you can only blame yourself, right?
Oh, 100%. My wife already knows. Every bad decision my kids make comes from me. You know, that's what I tell people. Now I just spend my days trying to make up for my youth, right? You know?
Wow, that's crazy. So, you know, they say one out of 1,000 high school players plays at the Division I level in college, and one out of 1,000 college players ever gets the chance to play in the NFL. So what an accomplishment that is. Can you talk a little bit about, like, your first time in the NFL or some significant events that occurred with you in the NFL, just to give people a perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. What that's like. I was blessed. I got to go. I knew I was going to go anywhere from the third to fifth round, and you know, Kansas City is where I wanted to go. So I'll never forget when I got drafted, I got a call from Coach Ramil, from Lamar Hunt, Carl Peterson, Lynn Stiles, like the entire front office was on. I was like, I'm a fourth round draft pick, you know. That was back when they only, you know, they had the first, it was only 2 days of the draft. They didn't have a 17-day draft period. Right. You know, they had three rounds and the second three rounds. So, or set four rounds, sorry. You know, one through three and then four through seven. Wow. You know, the next day. Now they do what? I think they do all the first round one day. Now it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But anyways, I got a call from there and I was shocked. And I came in and, you know, again, I think, for me, when I got drafted, it was a turning point, right? It was a scary moment for me, actually, because I had accomplished every childhood dream I ever wanted to accomplish. And it was really one of those self-reflection moments where I had to look and say, okay, am I happy? Is this my end goal, right?
Right.
And for me, it's never been, you know, getting to the NFL was never the option. I've always, everything I do, I want to be the best. I'm just compulsively driven like that. And so that's what motivates me. And so I really had to take a look at myself and say, okay, you know, you can be, you're there, but now what? Right. So I had to go back and reset all my goals, right? I had accomplished my life's work at this point. And I had to reset my goals. And so when I walked into training camp and I was behind a 9-year vet and Bonnie Holiday, we had Eric Hicks on the other side. You know, the Chiefs were just 13-3. You got Tony Gonzalez, you got Willie Rofe, Will Shields, you know, Brian Waters. I mean, the offensive line, I mean, three of them, I believe, are, two of them are in the Hall of Fame, you know, put Tony on there, you know, he's the three, you know, in the Hall of Fame, you know, so I came into a team that was just stacked with greatness on one side and, yeah, and veteran leadership on the other. And, you know, again, it can be scary. So I remember walking in and I told one of our counselors, Don Patterson, I said, I'm going to start. Like, that's my, I'm not comfortable being a backup. And so when I got there, I'll never forget, and this is a long-winded version of saying a significant moment in my career. I was running with the twos. I obviously when you first come into mini camps, right? And Lynn Stiles pulled me aside. I don't even remember what the significance of the practice was, but he pulled me aside and he said, he's like, hey, I just want to let you know, it's just football. The field is still 52 and a third wide, right? He's like, it's 120 end zone to end zone. You play long enough, you're going to play against the same guys you played against in college. He said, don't let the uniform fool you and think this game is any different. Just do what you do that got you here. And for me, that was a very, I'll never forget that advice because it really put things in perspective, right? It's that adage of how do you eat an elephant, right? You know, one bite at a time. Right. And where if I focus on the little things, if I just do what I'm really, really good at and playing football and not let the outside distractions and not focus on like, oh, this is the Kansas City Chiefs or that's the Oakland Raiders over there. Yep. Or that's and then your mind gets going, that's Tony Gonzalez. I'm a big fan. You know, if you focus on what your task is, you accomplish great things. And so for me, that was a significant turning point in just how I viewed, you know, that totality of where I was at. Right. And obviously I kept that mindset of just, you know, I'm a worker bee. I just put in work day in and day out and I was able to accomplish some great things.
That's awesome. Now, what you're talking about when you finally reached your lifetime goal, how you had to like reset your life goals at that point, cause you had accomplished everything. There was a study done many years ago about the Apollo program astronauts. And once they'd gone into outer space and come back, they found out that all these astronauts were getting really depressed. They couldn't figure out what's going on. They interviewed them all, and it was the exact same thing. They had had a lifetime goal of being a pilot. Back then, they're all pilots.
Yep.
And then going into outer space and becoming an astronaut. Like, how do you top that? I went into outer space, and I'm an astronaut. Now what do I do? And so they started working with them before they ever went on their space launch. What are you going to do afterwards? And so they all had to develop a plan for what they're going to do later in life after this was over, before they ever even got to do it. And that solved the problem because they were just getting depressed because they.
And you see that with athletes, you see that, you know, with the military, right? I always kind of referred to as a repurposing, right?
Yeah.
So many people are so driven towards one singular focused goal, right? So for me, I also grew up in church, right? You know, faith has been a part of my life since I was little. It's been stronger at certain points as we've all had these moments in our lives.
Right.
But for me, like finding my identity never solely lied in football. So that's step one, right? you have to know who you are as a total person. And I realized, you know, early in my career that no matter, let's just say I played 12 years, but let's say I played 15, even let's even just say I played 20 years, right? I would have retired when I was 33. I would have retired when I was like 40. Let's just say I was 40, right? That about 17, 20 year career. I still have hopefully 60 years plus of life left, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, for me, I always understood that football was such a small portion of my life, right? And I've always kind of viewed things as in chapters, as I alluded to earlier, when that one chapter of my life was accomplished, you know, a lot of people just, like you said, well, I've already accomplished it. They just are now, right? They don't have that same drive. And that's where you have the bust. In the NFL, you see bust every year. And it has nothing to do with their talent. It has everything to do with their mental drive or their mental capacity to challenge themselves to the next level, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, I've always just been able to do that. And so, you know, I always understood the NFL was this. And how do I use this short period of time to catapult the rest of my life, right? If I do really well in a short period of time, I can do whatever I want over here. So I was blessed financially. I was able to play, you know, relatively healthy. But now, and not to mention, I talk about networking, the people I've met, all this stuff. You know, I can make a couple phone calls and you have resources and you have fun. And I think that's what, you know, what people need to focus on is that each part of your life is just a chapter, right? You're constantly repurposing yourself. You're constantly repurposing your ideas. You're constantly, you know, refocusing your energy towards something. You know, when I was focused on football, that's what it is. Then I met my wife. Now there's another section I had to focus on, right? I have to focus on being a good partner to my wife. And then we had kids. It's like, okay, now I gotta learn this whole dad thing, right? So it's like you put all your energy and effort into that. So, you know, I always just say, you know, if it's that old adage, right? If you're standing still, you're stagnant. You're actually going backwards. If you're constantly pushing forward, whatever it is, it doesn't always have to be for financial achievements. It doesn't always have to be a career goal. It's as little as it can be faith. It can be your relationships. It can be parenting. It can be whatever. I think it does people well to view as chapters, right? View things as stepping stones and how I'm just going to continually get better at something in my life. Cause like you said, when you reach the pinnacle and you don't feel like you have anything else to go up, it's your natural, it's human, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess it's just
human nature.
There we go. Yeah. Human nature to be complacent. And complacency is the ultimate killer of joy, of hope, of everything.
Right. And all the studies with military folks, I think it's always been that, you know, people go in the military and they get out, but I think it's even more extreme. The more extreme your experience was in the military, whether combat operations, that kind of thing, or extreme training or operational stuff, the more extreme experience you had in the military, the more of a shock it is when you get out. And a lot studies will show the main cause of, you know, veteran suicide and all the problems is a lack of a sense of purpose. You have real purpose in the military. You're told what your purpose is, you know, most of the time. It becomes your purpose. You get out of the military, you're so glad to have that off your back and everything. But if you don't refocus and repurpose yourself and come up with a new purpose, then that's when bad things start.
Absolutely.
To happen.
And I think, you know, especially the military wise, these kids, they go in so young typically, right?
Yeah.
And I think where we do a disservice to our servicemen and women is, like you said, the astronauts started talking about what they're going to do when they get out, right? So their singular focus, when you go into the military, you're like, oh, you're young, guns a-blazing, you're full of patriotism, right? No matter what your MOS ends up being, you're full of that. You're all in. Well, guess what? That wears off. And then all of a sudden you get to the end, you know, what you were all in for, they don't have a use for you anymore. And now you're out. And now you've spent 5, you know, 4, 8, 12, whatever your duration is, being, like you said, being told what to do. And then you get out, no one's telling you what to do. Now you have to think for yourself again. So, you know, I think a lot of that, you got to, you know, people before they go into things need to think, what am I accomplishing here? Why am I doing this? What's my exit plan? What do I hope to learn in this strategy? Right. Because as you know, I mean, I tell people, you know, people that own companies all the time, military people have a fantastic skill set, right? I mean, from every basic skill set, I mean, you know, when I did my USO tour over 2009 in Iraq and Kuwait, just to be on the military bases and see the logistical like nightmare that it could be. I mean, just how many moving parts just to run a base to keep our forward operators out working, right? I mean, there's so much support staff. There's so many layers and levels to it that you're just like, man, this is a highly skilled unit, whatever you want to call. There's a lot of critical thinking going on. But if you're not taught how to transfer that, or you're not taught how to harness that and like you said, repurpose that into a different deal, it becomes lonely, right?
Yeah.
So that's you know what you're right on that, and it's not about the afterthought. You know, a lot of people talk about, well, what programs do we have for our veterans when they get out, right? It's really a preemptive strike. You need to have them planning their entire career. You need to have them on the forefront saying, okay, I'm going to go into this skill set, and I'm going to do my time, right. And then when I get out, I have avenues into these different roads.
Absolutely. Becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you earn more and save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you could start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money anytime, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement, maybe you want to consolidate debt. You could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed-rate home equity loan with zero closing costs, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Both options could help make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loans subject to approval. Every year, both the number and scope of data breaches worldwide are rising. According to the 2022 annual data breach report by the Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up nearly 41.5% from 2021. These data brokers aggregate your personal information, including your names, aliases, social security number, login credentials, home address, location history, online activity, and much more. In a nutshell, your personal information is being sold or published online without you even knowing about it. The good news is that you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information they hold about you. The bad news is, it would take you years to do it manually just once, and you'd need to repeat the process every few months as data brokers continue collecting your data and creating new records. The U.S. has another big data privacy problem, people search sites. These websites create detailed personal profiles on Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. Major people search sites like Been Verified provide varied and in-depth records, including information such as home addresses, contact details, license plate numbers, family members, financial information, and even religious and political beliefs. Go ahead, look yourself up on one of these sites. You know, I look myself up and yeah, there's a lot of information about me out there. Those looking for more specific details like court or property records can also use sites like arrest.org or Hometry. Fortunately, Incogni puts an end to this problem. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections. If you want Incogni to go to work for you, go to incogni.com/veteran and use the code veteran to check out and get an exclusive 60% off an annual subscription. That's incogni.com/veteran. All right, we're back talking with NFL player Jared Allen from Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors. So Jared, we actually have a niece. My wife's niece works for the Cleveland Browns now, and she's involved in the community outreach. Like, she's the one going out with the players to the local schools and communities, that kind of thing. Great job. She loves it. And I'm curious, we always see NFL players doing great things out in the community and stuff. I always wonder, like, are they just doing this completely on their own? Like, it was their idea? The NFL must have programs. I'm curious, from a player's perspective, how does the NFL approach that and get players out into the community and doing those kinds of things? What's that like from a player's perspective?
So the NFL as a whole, they kind of have, like, I mean, I don't know if it's still the United Way, but they've always had an overall kind of charity effort that they go for. But really, it's based on each team. And like you said, each team has a community outreach department.
Okay.
Right. And you have your community leaders. So a lot of times the teams will plan like maybe a monthly deal and stuff like that, or even can be weekly, where they get a lot of the younger guys out into the community to go, like you said, go read at the schools, go do this. But they're always there for players to come and say, hey, I want to do this. Right. And then they'll help them find that out. So the NFL does a really good job. There's a lot of resources available for players who want to be active in the community. Each organization tends to have like a minimum standard of, you know, of what they're going to do. And that's usually team-based. You ought to tell your wife's niece to tell Kevin Stefanski hello. He's an old coach of mine.
Oh, okay, I will.
So there's a Cleveland Brown connection there.
Awesome.
So yeah, but, so that is a very good focus, and I think every team understands that, you know, the fan base is obviously what drives the NFL, right? And so from a core corporate structural level, like every organization really does try to do a good job of a getting their players visible in a positive light and giving back to the community, right? Because, you know, we know much is given, much is expected, and we do take so much from those communities just from a support system, right? You know, obviously game days, and you live in those communities, and, you know, we're really counting on the fans. They drive the economics of the NFL. So any chance you get to get back in the community and do something on a positive note and let the fans know that you appreciate them on a different level. The NFL does a good job of providing resources for that. And like I said, each team is kind of different on what their, you know, what their avenues are, but from a whole NFL Shield perspective, it's very important, and they do provide any resources for anybody that wants to go as deep as you want to go.
So for you personally, you founded Jared Allen's Home for Wounded Warriors. Give us the background on that and how you got started there.
Yeah, so I come from a military family. My grandfather was 23 years in the United States Marine Corps. My little brother was a Marine. I mean, my whole family was Marine. I got an uncle that was like 36 years in the Air Force. I played football. That's the only reason I went the football route. Everybody else in the family went military route. They followed grandpa. So, you know, I've always had such a love and a passion for our military and a respect for our military. You know, I've always known that they were the reasons that I was able to do and accomplish what I wanted to do and live out my American dream. So in 2009, I went on a USO tour over to, like I mentioned earlier, to Iraq and Kuwait. And when I came back, you know, I had a buddy who was in the Army a few years earlier mentioned there was a gap in adaptive housing. So when I came back in 2009, I realized, like, you know, okay, I need to do something to give back to my country, right? You know, these men and women, they sacrificed. I think that was the biggest wake up for me, was that when I saw just, you know, husband, wives, daughters, brothers, you know, sisters, you know, You're there for 14 months sometimes, right? You may get a phone call a week. You know, sometimes communication is fine, depending on what your job is, depending on what you're doing over there. So just the daily sacrifices. And I remember there was a husband and a wife. They were both deployed together, but one outranked the other, right? Yeah. They weren't actually allowed to even like fraternize with each other. Otherwise, they would lose a rank. You know what I mean? So, you know, just seeing the simple things that we take for granted that were sacrifices over there, right, really made me focus on, when I got back, I wanted to make sure when our men and women came home that they had their slice of the American dream. And so I learned about the gap in adaptive housing. And so that's where we chose to jump in. And, you know, we started Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors in 2009. I didn't want to just write a check. I wanted to make a sustainable difference in the lives of these men and women coming home.
Awesome.
And we learned as we went, you know. We had some successes, we had some failures, but we've been cranking. I think we're close to 30 homes, you know, done. And so right. What we do is we build handicap accessible homes for wounded vets coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and that they're specific to the injuries and needs of those individuals. And then we give it to them free and clear, no mortgage, nothing like that, when it's all said and done. And so, you know, we. To be honest, we didn't even know the impact we were going to have on the military community when we did that. Yeah. And you talk about purpose, what that did. And I'll never forget. So Corey Remsburg was one of our recipients, and his dad told us one time, he said, man, every time Corey has a bad day. So Corey was an Army Ranger. President Obama announced him at the Union years ago. He got a standing ovation, but he was on like 10 deployments. Corey was an elite of the elite, you know, soldiers. Right. And he had some severe TBI on an accident.
Right.
But his dad told us, he said, you know, every time Corey has a bad day, I'd take him over to the house. Right. And I was kind of like, Corey was probably only maybe in our first five homes that we had done. And what he said, you know, he's like, it's his, that this house is his, it's his independence back. Right. So these alpha males, they come home, and alpha females, they come home from being injured, and, you know, they're used to taking care of themselves. They're used to doing things. They're used to being, you know, the ones getting things done. Now to come home and some of them live in a basement of a relative. You know, some of them are, the VA will put them in apartments that aren't handicap accessible, right? They do the bare minimum. And so the stressors of life come on. And now these people have people doing things for them that they want to do themselves. So, you know, if you're trying to learn what, you know, learn how to walk, talk, think again, based on some of these injuries, and you can't even move around your domicile freely and comfortably, like the added stress it puts on. And so what we saw was a huge psychological shift in our recipients. And, you know, when talking with Corey's dad over those years, he made it realize, he was like, man, this is a sign of independence. This is him being back on his own. This is him getting back his bravado, you know? And we saw that with a lot. We've had, you know, recipients on the suicide watch list, and now they're married with multiple kids. And it's because, again, they found that purpose, or they realized, like, you know, the pendulum swung back, right? So they're learning their new normalcy. And when, you know, for me, the reason we decided to build Handicap Accessible Home is because I was like, all right, what is my American dream? My American dream is a functional home for me and my family, right? Like, I want, you know, white picket fence, 2.5 kids and a dog, you know, whatever, yeah, whatever that picture of American dream is, but it's always centered around your home, right? And home is supposed to be your most secure place at your most vulnerable time, right? I mean, that's the whole point of where we choose to live, why we choose to live, for kids, neighborhoods, all this is, it's for security. It's that sense of calm that you can just brush the day off. And so, you know, that's what we really focused on, and that's what we've been able to deliver. And we've had great partners now, and we kind of just been cranking along since 2009. And, you know, we're a small organization and we do big work, and, you know, we're very, you know, family oriented. We still talk to all of our recipients, and, you know, we got Bobby Body. We just gave him a house, and he's going to be in the Paralympics for weightlifting. So, I mean, the stories are just inspiring. And I say it every time. Every time we do a key ceremony and I get to meet our recipients and spend some time with them, it just humbles you to your core, because the number one thing we hear is someone always deserves it more than them, right? And they're just their drive and the injuries that they fight through would bury some people. And they push through and they have, yeah, a positive attitude, and it really does. It humbles you, and it just makes you realize, like, that's the core fabric of this country. That's what this country's about. That's what they're fighting for. They're fighting for that hope, right? They're fighting for freedom. They're fighting for the right to dream. And so for me and my family, we'll support the military till we're off this earth.
That's awesome. Appreciate that. Hey, if somebody's interested to get more info on Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors, how do they do that?
Yeah, you can go to homesforwoundedwarriors.com or Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors.com. Our site's up there. It's pretty simple.
Awesome.
Okay. So I gotta check out all the social medias, but I don't even know. I don't do social media very well. So, I'd have to call Amanda.
Just Google it. They'll find you.
Yeah. Google it. It's out there.
Hey, so I got a business question, entrepreneur question for you. I've had a number of nonprofits on the show, and I always like to hear from their perspective, because before I started this podcast, I was looking at starting a nonprofit, and I'm like, I kind of want to go the for-profit route. I don't want to be involved in running a nonprofit for a number of different reasons. But I'd had some friends that had been kicked out of their own nonprofit by the board, you know?
Yep.
Just didn't fit my mantra for what I was looking to do. But so you're running a nonprofit. You founded your own nonprofit. Can you talk a little bit about the business aspects of it, or maybe, you know, like the not so pretty parts of it, or I'm in the fundraising business, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're spot on that, right? So, and I'll differentiate too. So there's two forms of nonprofits, right? There's your fund, and then there's your, and they're both 501c3s, right? But one's a fund-based and one is a 501, like mission-based, right? So we're a 501c3, we're a mission-based nonprofit, to where our funds have to go, we have to stay there, our mission statement, and our funds have to go directly toward it. So, like, our mission statement is we build handicap accessible homes for wounded veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. That is our scope of work, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be injured in Iraq or Afghanistan during combat. You have to be paralyzed, amputee, TBI, that's debilitating blindness. There's certain criteria that fit around there. So that's number one, is really diving in and narrowing your mission down. Right now, a fund can gather money. If I was Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors fund, or just fund, Jared Allen's fund, then basically I would raise money and then I would divvy that out to other nonprofits, or nonprofits would come. So we do receive money from other funds, like the Home Depot Foundation is a good partner of ours, right? Okay. So that's a fund. And they write checks to other nonprofits that fit within their, you know, core scope of what they align with. But we are mission based. So we everything we do drives around military and building homes for wounded vets coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we have to be very specific in that. And one thing, starting out was I never wanted to say no to people. So we have to make sure our guidelines are, I don't ever want people to go through my process, application process, and then be told, no, you have enough struggles in your life.
Yeah.
So we've been really cognizant of setting up our application process. So you don't get through if you don't qualify.
Okay.
Right. So there's no false hope. And, but the struggles of it are, yeah, I mean, it's just a nonprofit is just like any other business, right? Except, you know, you, all your profits go back to your cause. Obviously we have an executive director. He gets paid. We have, I only have three employees. But you have to raise money. And then your 990s are basically your public records of what you do with your funds, right? Yep. From your marketing expenses to this, that, and the other. And we try to be within 85 to 90% of every, so what that means is 85 to 90 cents of every dollar raised goes directly into our projects.
Yeah, that's great.
And you know, the IRS, to be honest, the IRS is thresholds very low and a lot of nonprofits operate in some marginal areas, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Our philosophy when we set out is that our brand will never get bigger than our purpose. Right. And you see that a lot. And I think, and that's yep. The big thing is when you, especially in the nonprofit world, because raising money can become that drive. I mean, being a $50 million raise, a $5 million raise, you know, I raised 5 million. Now I want to raise 10. Well, now I want to raise this. And it's that same competitive drive. It's the same way on the profit side, right? I made 5 million this year. I want to make 10 million. I want a $30 million company for it. So that drive can be the same, but then what happens is your brand gets bigger than your cause, and now you're solely focused on being this fundraising machine, and now you're hiring, you know, you're doing all these advertising, you're hiring people to raise more money, but that money's not going to your cause, and you got to be careful. So we've set very strict limits from an organizational standpoint to where that'll never happen, and you really have to hire the right people. And so fundraising is also different from the standpoint of a product. So for example, I've had a lot of people come to think, oh, I want to raise money. I want to do this. And smart people, raising money is a different beast because yep. You're not selling anything. You're selling your dream. You're selling your passion. I need you to believe in what I believe in and then write me a check. Yep. That's all there is to it. I don't have a product. There's no really return on your investment other than the goodwill you're seeing done with our recipients, right? I mean, that's enough. You get people to our tea ceremonies. They love it. And so you got to understand the fundraising philosophy. There's two ways to raise money, in my opinion. You beat people over the head till they write you a check and they want you to go away. Or they genuinely believe in your cause and they're all in, right? Yeah. And so we try to go with number two. And so when I first started this, though, like luckily for me, I had a platform. I had some buddies where owed me a favor and I was like, hey, I need a check, bro. but the real difficulty is what you have to understand is that it's, there's no room for, you can't be a fraud. That's what you have to genuinely believe in your cause, right? Mm-hmm. And the people you hire have to genuinely believe in your cause. Cause if you're sitting there asking someone for $100 to 200,000 to a million, whatever that price is, if they don't believe that you believe it, you're never going to get it. Right.
Yeah.
And then it's about being good stewards with your money and making sure you have the hard cuts of, hey, like for me, we never, there's, you can get grants based on who you have in your pipeline and what we do in our space. And I won't do that. We never approve a recipient until I already have the money and the house is already funded.
Wow.
Right. Awesome. Now, lucky for us, in-kind donations spend like cash in a lot of ways, right? Because if I get windows donated, that takes off my bottom line, all that stuff. So we have great partners that we've managed to get over the years, but it is that struggle because like you said, it's not like a normal sales pitch. I can go in there and I'm going to talk to them about saving, you know, veterans' lives and building homes and this and how we're going to use your product. But at the end of the day, I have to be like, so you in or you out? There's no way. Let me get a couple. Let me see how they fly off the shelves. We'll dip yeah. our toe in the water. You either got to be in or you're out because there's no middle ground there. And then the toughest part for me is, you know, and this is what I do. Not all good money is, you know, not all money is good money. Right. So right. I've cut some very big sponsors loose, some very big partners loose over the years because they didn't align with our core values and they didn't align, you know, with our mission statement. And for me, that is the number one thing. I won't let our foundation become the inside sales team for someone's product. And if you, and for myself, being a retired athlete, you're constantly trying to you know, manage that barrier of, are they trying to get my likeness for something, or do they genuinely believe in my cause? And yeah. So for that, so we run that strict, and I'm again, we put a lot of, you know, I'm like Wayne's World, right? If you build it, they will come. So we roll on those principles, and it's tough sometimes because, you know, we always joke about no good deed goes unpunished because we're building homes. So at the end of the day, it's still construction, right? You have hiccups, you have fraudulent contractors, you have people doing dumb stuff. It doesn't matter that it's given. And even sometimes we got to get with our recipients and be like, that you can't do that. Like, sorry, this is public money. So we have to be even better stewards than most people. And that's where people get caught, right? It's they, you know, for a for-profit business, you got some extra expenditures. You can go ahead and you write that off, or maybe you get it out of petty cash. You get it on the back end. For nonprofit business, every dollar we earn is public money, right? Every dollar has to be accounted for, and we have to be good stewards of that. There's a lot of similarities with for-profit and nonprofit when it comes down to the organizational structure and what you're doing. But the hiccups come with you have to be bold, you have to be passionate, you have to fully believe in your cause to get people to believe in it. And then you, like I said, we're very mission driven. So we have to be very careful of, you can't start, you know, it doesn't take long. You can get down one, you can be like, I think this works. And the next thing you know, you're three lanes over and you're like, crap, I got to get back in the center lane here. That's the constant battle. It's really evaluating our partners. Strategic partnership is huge in the nonprofit world. As it can be in the for-profit world, but strategic partners are, for us, is big because, you know, that's where we're allowed to operate lean, and that's where we're allowed to be able to keep our margins where they are because we have great partners that fill up those buckets for us without us having to spend capital on it.
Wow. Okay, Jared, I got to hand it to you. There are a lot of guys in your position that could be the figurehead of an organization and just, you know, show up and shake hands and smile. You obviously know what you're talking about when it comes to running a nonprofit, and you got your hands dirty and all of it. So good on you.
I did it for the first so many years. I got to give credit to our executive director, Alex Karalexis, a good buddy of mine. I've known him. He fought in the UFC for years. So I've known him for many, many years. But he was talking about the hardships. Like when we first brought him on, same thing. You know, he was coming over from working out of buddies on the sales team, right? And then, you know, he's trying to raise money, and it's like, you know, but now, and he has a background in carpentry. He was a carpenter and stuff like that when he was younger. So when we moved him over to the, you know, project management side, all of a sudden, you know, now money's coming in, right? He understands how to talk to those people. So just like any other organization, right? You got to put your people in the right spot to succeed as well. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, so like our team is my buddy Alex and our good friend Amanda. And those two work great. And then our accountant, our bookkeeper, Karen. But those three, and again, it's one of those things where our team works so well together, and it's because of how we've aligned our strategic partnerships. And we're also, again, you have to be, I don't know the best way to put this, like you have to be so true to your like core competencies, right? That this person might have all the qualifications and ever, but if they don't fit the mold, if they cannot operate within that team, and that's where like team structures come in, right? If they cannot operate, they could be the most talented person, but if they don't work well within that, in that environment, you got to get rid of. Sometimes more is less, and that's kind of the approach we take. It's very much, you know, wear many hats, but make sure you're wearing them well.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And like I said, I'm a lot more hands off now. Our team, like I said, we have a great team in place. So I know as the chairman, I know exactly what's going on, but I don't have to do a lot of the legwork anymore. Yeah. Unfortunately, sometimes you got to get called in and do certain things, but you know, and now just like anything else, it's about managing relationships because, you know, right, especially in the nonprofit world, the relationships are key. And so, you know, we have fantastic relationships with Home Depot. I was able to go down there. See, I still love it because I get put in places where I get to learn more. I get to go down to speak, at the head of our Home Depot corporate offices to their executives, all their executive meeting teams. Like, I think it was like 100, 200, you know, executives and regional vice presidents, all these. And I got to meet the CEO of Home Depot. And so you sit there and you get to talk, and we're the small organization, right? Just trying to do right by people.
Yeah.
And here we are speaking in front of a Fortune 20. I think Home Depot is a Fortune 20 company, right?
Yeah.
And so, man, so sometimes I still just kind of look around. I'm like, this is pretty cool. And you learn, you're constantly learning. And so, you know, that's the big thing I would encourage people to, whether it's for profit, whether it's nonprofit, with that entrepreneurial spirit, hey, always be willing to learn. Don't be afraid of the work, and make sure you have the right people that have the same core value system as you in place.
That's awesome. I was just going to ask, I usually ask it, we're over time on the interview, so we got to get going, but I was going to ask, what final advice do you have to somebody looking to get into entrepreneurship? But I think you just answered that.
There you go.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be, first and foremost, right? If you don't love what you're doing, it's obvious. I always say that about football. I said, in football, one great thing about football, you cannot be a fraud. In a locker room, an alpha male locker room will weed out any fraud, right? You will get exposed if you're a fraud, because the film, we have to say, film don't lie. Yeah. And I think it's that in life, right? Like, people know when someone shows up and they're just there for the paycheck. And that's fine if you're working for a major corporation and, you know, and you just have your singular task. But if you're an entrepreneur and you're trying to build something, you have to be all in. You have to be passionate about it, because you're creating that culture, right? You're creating that brand. You're creating the energy behind it. And, you know, you want people to invest in that. And at the end of the day, you know, most, I'd say 95% of people are investing in people, not necessarily the product.
Yeah. Wow. Awesome. Well, hey, Jared, we do have to go. So I appreciate you being here and telling your story, and especially your entrepreneurial success story. Appreciate you sharing all the details with us and everything. And look forward to seeing the future success of your Homes for Wounded Warriors.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You bet. All right. We're Oscar Mike. Thank you for listening to Veteran on the Move, your pathfinder to freedom. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes. Reviews are always greatly appreciated. So until next time, this veteran is Oscar Mike.